Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to see his woods fill up.
It's to watch his woods fill up.
Oh, let's try that again. Hello, and welcome to the Mind on Fire podcast. It is, this is episode 4. It's Monday, May 18th, 2009, and it is a sunny day in Southern California, and I am broadcasting out of my little closet. On this podcast, we cover many of the same topics that we cover over at the blog, and if you're coming across this podcast on iTunes or FeedBurner or someplace besides the blog is mindonfire.com, and please feel free to stop by for the links for this show, for any comments, or to participate in the community here. But as I was saying, the topics on the show, on the podcast, may include skepticism, atheism, feminism, religion, spirituality, geeky things, science fiction, and the intersection of all of these things and none of these things. Today, my daughter Catgirl and I are going to review the Hugo nominees for the short story category for 2009, so stay tuned. Oh, and really quick, I just wanted to record us, the two of us, reciting our one of our favorite poems. We're not reading, we're reciting. So here goes.
Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though.
He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without the farmhouse near. Between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. These woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. Good job. So, we're going to talk a little bit about, Catgirl, say hi.
Hi.
She's waving. So, I should introduce Catgirl a little bit. What should we say about you?
I don't know.
You are in junior high school.
Mm-hmm.
How about something geeky that you like or do?
Well, I was listening to the Hugo nominees.
That's...
While doing my math homework.
That's pretty, I think that would qualify as a geek. Oh, and you like Doctor Who, you love Doctor Who.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
I think you've watched more episodes of Doctor Who than I have.
I do believe I have,
because
we were watching it. Yeah, forgot about that.
Okay, I think that qualifies. Yeah, we'll throw in more details about you throughout. Okay, so back to the Hugo nominees. Both Catgirl and I have read. Actually, we didn't read. We listened to the five Escape Pod episodes, and Escape Pod is the premier science fiction podcast out there. They do. Our cat is wanting to come in. Maybe, poor kitty. Hi, Bobette. So now we have three of us in on this podcast.
Meow.
So, Escape Pod is this wonderful podcast out there. We'll provide links in the episode notes. But basically, every week they publish a short story read by a lot of times by voice actors, by
science fiction
podcasters out there. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. So Escape Pod does science fiction stories. They do one a week, And the stories are always by many of the best science fiction authors out there. So they really are picking the best stories. And every year, as a service to science fiction fandom, they podcast the Hugo-nominated short stories, five of those. And so we're able to listen to these for free. I like listening to them because it's hard for me to find time to sit down and read a story. But I'm always biking somewhere or doing something with my hands, but not with my brain. And so
I like being able to listen to them while doing homework.
So you're not using your brain during homework?
Well, it depends on the homework.
But not for math?
Well, it depends. Because I can't read while listening, but I can do math while listening.
Wow, that'd be pretty impressive, because you'd be reading.
Well, you know, like, reading.
Like, yeah, dual reading. So we have listened to all five of these stories. We're not going to give away any spoilers. But
try not to.
We want to. Hopefully we'll entice you to read some of these stories yourself, and we'll talk a little bit, read / listen, however you want to read it, audibly or visually. So there are five stories, and this is how we've decided to do this format. We're going to read a short excerpt from each story, and we'll introduce the title and the author, and then we'll just talk for a few minutes about it. So the first story is called, it's by Kidge Johnson. It's called 26 Monkeys, also The Abyss. Just a word about Kidge Johnson. She is one of the few authors who does anything with ancient Japanese themes. Her fantasy is that she's written is based in Heian-era Japan, so this is why she's been on my radar for a long time. She's also my Facebook friend. But she almost always writes about animals, so I'm sure that this is something that would endear her to Catgirl.
I've never
read any of her other stories.
No,
we'll have to remedy that. So do you have anything you want to say about Kiss Johnson?
I've never read anything or listened to anything of hers before, so.
You just said that. Okay, so here's a brief excerpt from this story. It's at the beginning. 1. Amy's big trick is that she makes 26 monkeys vanish on stage. 2. She pushes out a claw-foot bathtub and asks audience members to come up and inspect it. The people climb in and look underneath, touch the white enamel, run their hands along the little lion's feet. When they're done, 4 chains are lowered from the proscenium stage's fly space. Amy secures them to holes drilled along the tub's lip, gives a signal, and the bathtub is hoisted 10 feet into the air. She sets a stepladder next to it. She claps her hands, and the 26 monkeys on stage run up the ladder, one after another, and jump into the bathtub. The bathtub shakes as each monkey thuds in among the others. The audience can see heads, legs, and tails, but eventually every monkey settles, and the bathtub is still again. Zeb is always the last monkey up the ladder. As he climbs into the bathtub, he makes a humming boom deep in his chest. It fills the stage. And then there's a flash of light. 2 of the chains fall off, and the bathtub swings down to expose its interior. Empty. So that's the excerpt. I like this story. It's mostly a story. It's less about the monkeys and more about Amy's search for meaning in her life, right?
Yeah.
And
one thing I noticed just a couple minutes ago is that the 26 monkeys correspond to the letters of the alphabet.
No,
possibly.
No.
Because the last one is Zed, which starts with
Z. The last one is Zed, but there are a few. When she goes through and names all the monkeys off, some of them have the names that start with the same letter. And she also talks about how at some points there are different numbers of monkeys.
Oh, Oh, yes, that's right.
But I think this 26 month, the number 26 is significant in that we impose meaning on that.
Mm.
And this actually works with the story, right?
That Zeb is the last monkey.
Okay, I think you're probably right. There is some sadness in this story.
Yes, there is some sadness.
And, wow, what else can we say about it?
There's some sort of magic, but it's, no one's really sure exactly what it is.
I just want to return to us for a second about the, so both of us kind of found meaning in that 26, but there's one point where she talks about how the number of monkeys changes over time. And because so much of this story is about imposing meaning, yeah, or finding meaning, I wonder if that isn't another trick of the author, Kitz Johnson, either consciously or subconsciously. And the title's kind of important, right? And so you put a little thought into even something like the number.
I think it's interesting that the title is 26 Monkeys, Also the Abyss, not just 26 Monkeys.
Right, right. Well, that makes it more interesting, yeah, too.
But I think that is interesting.
So, the other thing that we should talk about, too, is how we would vote. The members of Worldcon would pick one of these stories. I was a voting member of Worldcon last year, but I didn't actually go to the conference, and I may do that again this year. So, you know, which story would we actually pick as our favorite story? I like this story.
It's same here, but I don't think it's my favorite.
It's not your favorite, and why is that?
It's, since it's from Amy's point of view, it's slightly, I don't know how to explain it exactly, but, like, it almost feels like it doesn't have meaning, because in Amy's life, she's searching for this meaning, and yet it doesn't have this meaning that she's searching for.
So you're saying that the story itself,
you're searching for a meaning in it, and it doesn't have meaning.
You don't get the meaning that you're hoping that you get to. I was kind of satisfied with what she,
finally ended with.
Yeah.
I was satisfied with the ending.
But, yeah, and I think it was a well-done story.
I think the thing I don't like is the way it's written. It's also almost detached, because that's the way Amy feels.
Mm-hmm.
So she's almost detached from the rest of the world.
Detached, or?
Detached.
So, the things that actually the author has done well in portraying Amy's life are what you're saying makes it less of a
appealing story,
like a world award-winning story or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I like the way it's written, but it doesn't make my favorite.
Well, that is kind of ironic.
Yeah.
Well, how about we say one more thing? Who would this story appeal to? If you like monkeys, you'll like this story.
There's actually are always two good monkey stories. Two, yeah, that's right. Monkey stories.
Out of five, there are two about monkeys,
which is an interesting occurrence.
It is kind of disproportionate, it seems. There were no
people just like monkeys. Maybe
there were no stories about octopi, which I
there was a story that
offends
had
me.
Millipedes in it.
Yeah, but millipedes are not. They're octopi. Octopods. As we're looking in my little office at all of these octopus pictures, most of which you've drawn. So if you like monkeys, you'll like this story. You'll like it probably as kind of you may like it as an allegory for life. If you're someone who's kind of searching for meaning. So I'll tell you what, we'll stop there with this story and we'll move on to the next one. Which is one of Emma's favorites, maybe even her most favorite. It's called Article of Faith. This one's written by Mike Resnick. This one also deals with kind of meaning and like life purpose and life meaning. And
a little bit, yes.
Yeah, but it's more of kind of a character story, I think, right?
Yeah.
So Mike Resnick is, I believe he's one of the most award-winning science fiction authors out there. I know
we've listened to quite a few of his stories on Escape Pod.
Yeah, he does a lot of short stories. He's someone whose name you always see on the cover of like Asimov Science Fiction magazine. So, do you want to talk a little bit about this? Oh, I guess I should read the excerpt first. Should I read it towards the beginning?
I don't think the very first bit is quite the best bit.
Yeah, this... so here, I'll go a little bit deeper into the story. This is about a reverend, a preacher, and his...
Christian preacher.
Robot. Yeah, so a Christian preacher a little bit in the future, and he has a robot servant who helps sweep up stuff. So, let's see. So the Reverend says, "Somehow lunch seems pretty trivial after you've been thinking about God all morning." Then the robot says, "God, sir? The creator of all things," I explained. "My creator is Stanley Kalinowski, sir," said Jackson, the robot. "I was not aware that he created everything in the world, nor that his preferred name was God." I couldn't repress a smile. "Sit down, Jackson," I said. He placed a tray on my desk. "On the floor, sir?" "On a chair." "But I am merely a robot," said Jackson. "I do not require a chair." "Perhaps," I said, "but it would make me more comfortable if you sat on it." "Then I shall," he said, seating himself opposite me. "It is true that you were created by Dr. Kalinowski," I began, "or at least I have no reason to doubt it. But that implies another question, does it not, Jackson?" The robot stared at me for a moment before answering. "Yes, sir," he said at last. "The question is, who created Stanley Kalinowski?" "Very good," I said. "And the answer is that God created him, just as God created me and every other human being, just as he created the mountains and plains and oceans." Another pause. "God created everything except me?" he asked at last. So I'll stop there, and we have another cat coming in. This is probably a result of having Cat Girl in the office recording the podcast. So, anyhow, so the story is essentially about it's a very well written story. It's dominated by the two main characters are this robot
and the preacher.
A curious robot and the preacher. This story makes me think of. It's written a lot like a lot of the Isaac Asimov robot stories, right?
It reminds me of the Bicentennial Man, which I read just a couple days ago.
What kind of parallels do you see between the two?
It's about a robot who sort of questions what the accepted stuff for robots to be to do.
Like, what is accepted by society as a robot's place in that society.
Yes.
And so Jackson has...
Also a robot that has a bit different wiring than other robots. Right.
Now, you read this story after... You read The Bicentennial Man after reading this story, but can you see how this one is definitely influenced by stories like The Bicentennial Man, right?
Yes.
Now, I think... You would. The one thing that Resnick does really well, he does character stories really well, and even though, like most science fiction stories, there's an idea at the core. In this one, you really can feel very close to both Jackson and the Reverend, right?
Yes, yes, you can sympathize with both of them.
And
I'm not entirely sure who is more of a main character, the Reverend or Jackson. Because it's from the Reverend's point of view, and he definitely is, if he's not the main character, he's almost the main character. But
And the story is definitely about the relationship and the interaction between the two. Yeah. And like any good story, there's tension in that relationship, or at least they're it builds up.
We don't want to give too much away.
But What is it that you... Because I know this is one of your favorite stories. Maybe your favorite story of the group?
Maybe.
Maybe? Maybe. So maybe if you were to cast a vote, it might be this story.
Maybe. Possibly, yes.
Okay. And why is that? What is it about this story that appealed to you?
Oh, I don't want to give that much away.
Yeah, we have to be really careful talking about these so that we don't give away spoilers. That's our cat trying to... I don't know if you can hear that, but our cat's scratching the door trying to get in.
She can get in.
Okay, so
I think what I like about it is... It's sort of the separation from the standard, I suppose.
What do you mean?
Like, the idea that...
Oh. Let me pause this really quick. Okay, there's a little bit of a kitty chase break there. But I think in the interest, she's already come back again. So, Catgirl, where did we leave off? You were talking about why you like the story so much.
I don't know if it caught this, but I like the way it sort of separates from the norm. I like the idea that it's so hard to say it without giving stuff away. I like the idea that a robot can question, religion. Like,
so that's what appealed to you, is that this robot had very human
valid points.
Emotions and had serious questions,
I think,
right?
I think part of the reason I like this is partially because I've had, I've considered some of the things he's thinking about.
Right, you've had your own questioning and...
Yeah, I suppose I can relate. I suppose that's part of it. But I like that they're considering that. It's so hard not to give away. I like that they're considering that the Bible might be referring to more than man. They're questioning that.
Right, right.
It's
they're trying to figure out where robots fit.
Where's the line is, yeah.
Right. So in that sense, Resnick does a good job of doing
it. Yeah, I think it's wonderfully written.
This does make me... I think one of the reasons why this isn't one of my favorites is because it seems like, having grown up reading, like, Asimov's robot stories...
So I haven't read very many of those, so...
I feel like that this covers a lot of territory that's already been covered. There's some new little twists... in how this robot approaches religion, I think that's why there was nothing. It was a good story. It was a solid story, but I definitely enjoyed it. But there was nothing really refreshing for me in the story. I think that's why it's not going to be one of my top choices.
Before I read the Bicentennial,
right. So okay, let's move on to the next story. Oh, hold on.
I would like to say who we would recommend to read it.
Oh, yeah. So who would you recommend to read it?
I'd say anyone who's listening to this podcast.
Because it's online on fire. Yeah. So.
Yeah. But I think it's really interesting that the religious point of view. So if you're questioning religion, or just if you're a Christian or anything like that.
If you're thoughtful about religion, this isn't a bad story. Religion, yeah.
No matter where you stand on the spectrum.
All right. And if you like Isaac Asimov's robot stories, you'll probably like this one too.
Yes.
So, and if you like Mike Resnick. Okay, so next story that we're going to talk about is Evil Robot Monkey. This is by Mary Robinette Kowal. I want to talk just briefly about the author. She is a professional puppeteer. She's also, I think she won the John Campbell Award for Best Science Fiction Author last
year.
Amazing
author. Listened to several podcasts.
She's a great voice actor. She's someone who has her hands in a lot of different projects online, and I followed her blog for a long time, and it's kind of fun to see her career developing in this way. That said, this isn't one of my favorite stories, but we'll introduce it. It's Evil Robot Monkey by Mary Robinette Kowal. I already said that. So let me just read an excerpt from this. Someone banged on the window of his pen. Sly jumped and then screamed as the vase collapsed under its own weight. Oh, he's shaping a vase out of clay. He spun and hurled it at the picture window like feces. The clay spattered against the plexiglass, sliding down the window. In the courtyard beyond the glass, a group of school kids leapt back, laughing. One of them swung his arms, aping Sly crudely. Sly bared his teeth, knowing these people would take it as a grin, but he meant it as a threat. Swinging down from his stool, he crossed his room in three long strides and pressed his dirty hand against the window. Still grinning, he wrote SSA. Outside, the letters would be reversed. The student's teacher flushed as red as a female in heat and called the children away from the window. She looked back once as she led them out of the courtyard, so Sly grabbed himself and showed her what he would do if she came into his pen. Her naked face turned brighter red, and she hurried away. When they were gone, Sly rested his head against the glass. The metal in his skull thunked against the window. It wouldn't be long now before a handler came to talk to him. Damn, he just wanted to make pottery. Okay, I'll stop there. This is a very short story, and it's about this robot monkey.
It's about an ape who has a...
He's not a monkey.
It's an ape who has a robotic brain. So he's sort of in the in-between between... He's as intelligent as a human, but he's still an ape. So he's sort of on this borderline, and that the story is about how he feels about that.
Yeah, and I think even in the short excerpt that I shared, you probably can get a sense of what a good job Kowal does of telling from his perspective, yes. Right? He is still very much an ape at heart in his how he approaches the world, his social... But he's smart enough to also...
Bring a human... He approaches the world with an ape's, instincts, but then he reacts to it in a human-like way.
Right. And not only that, but it shows how he can also know how... interpret how a human might respond to him, right?
Yeah.
So he's like the grin part. He's like, even though he was baring his teeth as a threatening gesture, he knew that the humans would probably interpret it as a grin, and not as a threatening thing. And so, silly cat. I mean, Kowal does a great job of giving you a sense of, and she does a great job of characterization, right?
Yeah.
I can't wait to read some of her longer work, because I know that...
This is really short.
Yeah. And this is actually one of my beefs with the story.
It's really short.
It was too short for me.
It doesn't have very much plot. It's more of an excerpt into Sly's life.
Yeah. It gives you this window into Sly's life, and it's a great window. There's a little bit of tension in there, and there's certainly, it's a dense bit that you're given. But when you're comparing this to
the others,
four other very strong stories, it's not enough to. I wouldn't vote for it against. Certainly against a couple of the other stories.
Plot.
Yeah. Well, I would even be okay with voting for a more in-depth character story. One that may not be as plot-driven either. But
there's plot in the character.
Yeah. So it's not a... Anyhow, So that's my main beef with the story. It's over in like 5 to 10 minutes, I think.
And they've had really long intros and outros on this episode.
So, but definitely keep your eye out for Kowal. Would you vote for the story? Would you consider voting for it?
I really like the story. I like where Sly is put on the spectrum. Like, he's in between human and the ape. It's an amazing idea, but...
There's another character in there, too. One of the trainers that comes in and talks to Sly.
Who's actually not afraid of him.
Yeah.
And he actually sort of understands him.
Yeah.
Which is... sort of impressive.
And I did enjoy the interaction between the two of them. But... okay.
It's really short.
So
who would we recommend this to?
You know, sure enough, I would recommend that everybody listen to it.
It's really short. If you skip the intro and outro on the Escape Pod episode, it's like 5 minutes.
And again, we're going to give you the link to the actual story itself, too. So, but definitely, I would recommend it to any science fiction fan out there as an introduction to Mary Robinette Kowal. Who I know is she's a rising star, and I'm looking forward definitely to seeing much more from her. So, okay, let's move on to the next story,
which is Exhalation.
Ah, and this is one of my favorites. This is the one I would probably vote for. This is by Ted Chiang. Ted Chiang is I have seen him referenced by other. Science fiction writers as the master of the science fiction short story. I don't even know where to begin with him. The two stories that I've read of his recently take these personal stories but incorporate build up to these grand themes. The previous story that I read of his is called Hell is the Absence of God. And so it deals on a lot of the religious themes that are fascinating to me. But he does this world creation. That story is about...
this story has an amazing world.
Yeah.
It's totally drawn up out of nowhere.
So just really quick, the Hell is the Absence of God is about... and that one's actually available on Podcastle, which is a sister podcast of Escape Pod. The Pseudopod is the horror one, and Podcastle is the fantasy one. And Ted Chiang's Hell is the Absence of God is available to listeners through Podcastle. I think it came out earlier this year, so if you did a search on their website, you could find that. But he, in that one, he creates this world where angels and God are... real, but kind of, they have rules set up, they're kind of distant. But anyhow, I would highly recommend that, to Mind on Fire readers. Mind on Fire readers might like this one as well. This story does an amazing, amazing job of world creation, and let me start with an excerpt.
I like the first bit on this one.
Yeah. Okay, so this is from Exhalation by Ted Chiang. It has long been said that air, which others call argon, is the source of life. This is not, in fact, the case, as I engrave these words to describe how I came to understand the true source of life and, as a corollary, the means by which life will one day end. For most of history, the proposition that we drew life from air was so obvious that there was no need to assert it. Every day, we consume two lungs heavy with air. Every day, we remove the empty ones from our chest and replace them with full ones. If a person is careless and lets his air level run too low, he feels the heaviness of his limbs and the growing need for replenishment. It is exceedingly rare that a person is unable to get at least one replacement lung before his installed pair runs empty. On those unfortunate occasions where this has happened, when a person is trapped and unable to move, with no one nearby to assist him, he dies within seconds of his air running out. So, this is typical of Ted Chiang, I think.
He messes with your expectations.
He totally messes with your expectations. So, like that first line, it has long been said that air is the source of life, is something that immediately we can all relate to, right? We might disagree with it in particulars, but, you know, air, life. And we might disagree with that argon bit, too. But then he brings up this whole replacing your lungs business.
So he creates a world that's... You're not entirely sure who the inhabitants are. They're not obviously not human, but they're human-like if they breathe from lungs.
And they're human enough, and how they
they seem human.
Yeah. Well, the author. But they're obviously not. The author himself. I'm guessing him. I don't. He speaks very. I think he uses he pronouns.
Yeah.
So this is told from the perspective of one of these people in this world, and just like you have that little revelation in that first paragraph about Ted Chiang builds this connection with you, the reader, and then does a little twist on that to show, well, you're not removing your lungs at the end of each day, so. There's a difference here. And he's really good at that. He makes a connection. You feel for this main character.
Or you're expecting something, and then he totally, like, says, oh, never mind.
Yeah, he totally twists that expectation around. And at the same time he's doing that, through each of those twists of expectation, he's creating an entire world. And it's a complex world, and it's deep. And then he's asking these philosophical questions through the character, through this world creation, which is just...
The questions are the same questions you might ask here, and yet the answers are totally different. Or they might even not be.
Yeah, what I'm trying to remember some of the questions. I mean, this is a really dense story that you could go back and read again and again, and
get something new. Which is why when I first read it, I would not have voted for it because I didn't really get it.
Right, because it's...
Like, I got the main point of it, but it just... There's so much to it. It just didn't fully...
Yeah, I read stories like that, too, sometimes, where I don't get it, but at the same time, the author hasn't done a good job of hooking me in. So, even though I don't get it, I don't want to get it. This one, I definitely did... want to try it. So the author, just so you know, the narrator ends up performing a dissection of his own brain.
See, that's what I didn't like about the story. I think he could have written it without actually including the dissection and still given it the same idea. I think that is a little bit unnecessary.
I
think that draws it out a little bit.
It was kind of long. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't like
it. Actually, like the revelation that he has in this.
I think he could have put that into a. I think he could have written a story that was like that. It had that revelation, but it didn't actually include the in detail dissection.
Okay, I can see that.
It was more of a musing of what he'd already done.
It worked for me because he has this self-discovery about how his brain operates, and then from there projects that out into the whole world.
And this becomes like a famous scientist sort of thing.
And this is one of the things that... this is one of the metaphors where he learns something about his own brain... Then that gives him a revelation for how the whole universe works, and to me, I see that in storytelling, and there are all these layers in here that there are metaphors for storytelling. There are metaphors for making sense of our world.
What is really interesting is I'm sort of trying to find, like, what the parallels and what sort of time period this would be if this was if this was our world. Like, when we were doing dissections of our own brains, but human brains.
Okay, anybody who's a steampunk fan would love this story. This has, it's, these beings are kind of clockwork beings, essentially. But they're not that simplistic. Again, it's hard to just categorize Ted Chiang this way. But yeah, they're definitely machine-like. Their life, definitely. Oh, they also have questions about creation. That's another one of the philosophical questions that enters there. But anyhow, so they are kind of mechanistic beings, and that adds to the appeal of the story. And the way that he talks makes me think of 19th century scientists, right?
Yeah, that's where I'm sort of thinking.
Kind of Victorian era. Yeah. And so anybody who likes kind of the style of steampunk would really, I think, enjoy this. The one thing it doesn't have is the grittiness of a lot of steampunk, the cynicism towards the world. This one's it's actually a fairly optimistic story for some of the tragic circumstances in there. I would... So, yeah, just to go into the recommendation phase, I would definitely recommend this towards anybody who likes steampunk. Anyone who is interested in... boy, I was just going to say, to me, this is such a refreshing story when I think about science fiction. And I've read a lot of science fiction short stories. This one definitely defies a lot of genre tropes, and
I mean, it's
a definitely a unique
story. It's almost like set into the past and yet in a science fiction-y world.
Yeah, and it's in a, but maybe it is a completely different world. So I would say that I would probably vote for this story. We have one more story to talk about, but if I had to choose one, it would definitely be this story. Mm. And I am actually looking forward, now that we've talked about it, to reading it again or listening to it again. And I don't do that very often with science fiction short stories.
I've actually listened to Article of Faith twice.
Twice? How fun. All right. Do you have anything else that you want to say about this one?
I think this one's sort of your favorite, so I think you've sort of gotten...
Yeah, I've talked a lot about it. Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to the next story, and the last story, which is called From Babel's Fallen Glory We Fled. And this one's by Michael Swanwick. Michael Swanwick is like Mike Resnick, someone you see all the time in Asimov's, and just a very prolific and award-winning science fiction storyteller. Okay, so I'm going to... let me just read the first couple of paragraphs. Imagine a cross between Byzantium and a termite mound. Imagine a jeweled mountain, slender as an icicle, rising out of the steam jungles and disappearing into the dazzling pearl-gray eyes of Gehenna.
Skies.
What did I say?
Eyes.
Oh, thanks. Imagine that Gaudi, he of the Sagrada Familia and other biomorphic architectural whimsies, had been commissioned by a nightmare race of giant black millipedes to recreate Barcelona at the height of its glory, along with touches of the Forbidden City in the 18th century and Tokyo in the 22nd, all within a single miles-high structure. Hold every bit of that in your mind at once, multiply by 1,000, and you've got only the faintest ghost of a notion of the splendor that was Babel. Now imagine being inside Babel when it fell. Hello, I'm Rosamund. I'm dead. I was present in human form when it happened, and as a simulation chaotically embedded within a liquid crystal data matrix then and thereafter up to the present moment. I was killed instantly when the meteors hit. I saw it all. So,
I really like that first paragraph.
That first, how it begins? Yeah, you mean the description at the beginning?
Yeah, just the very first, like, it's Byzantium and Forbidden City in Tokyo.
It's very descriptive, yeah.
I like that it says Tokyo in the 22nd century because that gives you an idea of the time period.
Right.
It's obviously set fairly far in the future.
Because they're looking back.
And it's obviously humans in the future because it's the...
So they do, this one is more, in a lot of ways, it's a, of all the stories that we read, this is a classic science fiction story, I think.
Yes.
And a very well done one. It's full of new ideas.
26 Monkeys, also The Abyss, was more of a fantasy than a science fiction.
Yeah, yeah.
They mentioned that.
Which is okay, yeah, I think.
That's Hugo.
For the Hugo Award, yeah. But this one is more of a classic science fiction story. It has definitely some pretty interesting ideas that it's playing with, right?
Yeah.
And there's aliens and humans with different perspectives.
Yeah, but the thing that we really like about this one is the perspective it's from.
The narrator, yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of an omnipresent, yet they don't get all of the, I don't know how to...
The story is told from the perspective of this, of Rosamund, who is...
Her present, her, I don't know, like her spirit almost, is captured in this sort of science fiction-y suit.
She's basically an artificial intelligence,
yes,
like a simulation or
so she can't,
an imprint of a human named Rosamund, who you discover...
She can't react on what's happening.
Well, she does react.
But she
can react to the suit, through the suit's
Yeah, imperatives. But she doesn't, like, give opinions or...
Right, right.
Which makes it a really interesting story to read because of that.
So... That's one...
it's almost told in the third person because of that.
Yeah.
Even
though it's told from her first person.
For a point, I thought almost as if the Rosamund thing in the beginning was a mistake because it seemed as if it was told from the third person.
But so it's a clever device that Swanwick uses.
Yeah.
The other thing that we kind of liked about this... There's humans, and then there's this alien species that they're interacting with,
which are the giant millipedes.
The giant millipedes, not octopods, sadly. And they,
their currency is trust,
right? Where
the humans' currency is
information,
knowledge, yeah.
And so they talk about economies of trust, economies of information, and some of this has application to our existing world too, where we definitely see kind of the rise of information as the thing with value.
Yeah.
And if you study like Marxist economic history, it used to be that land was what determined wealth, and then labor, and now people are saying we're moving from labor to more of an information economy. So
it's almost metaphoric. The whole trust and knowledge.
Yeah, and the trust thing is interesting too, because so much of our own economy is based on trust. Mm-hmm. Oh, all of this, by the way, is it sounds like that there's. This story is all exposition or something, the way that we're telling it. But these are almost kind of side things that are driving the motives of the two main characters. Yeah. And
the plot is almost unimportant.
Well, yeah, I guess in some ways it is.
It's important to the story, but it's not the motive of the story.
This is another story where it's a human and an alien in their kind of trekking through the... hostile alien wilderness together.
It's their relationship that's important, and yet it's not told from either of their perspectives.
Yeah, it's told.
And it's not told from a perspective that the narrator is reflecting on their relationship. So it's so odd to read.
There was one other thing that I thought was really interesting. Let's see if I can remember it. So we talked about the economies. That was one idea that was really fascinating. This perspective of the suit was really interesting. Mm-hmm.
I just listened to this one, like, half an hour ago.
Yeah, that's right. Anything else you want to say about it?
Not really. I like the story. It's not my top, but it's definitely a good one.
Anybody who's a real fan of the solid science fiction of the type that you would find in Asimov's or in fantasy and science fiction magazines, you would probably enjoy this story. It is a well-crafted, solid piece of work with a lot of good ideas in it. There's a good story in the heart of it with, you know, it's different enough that it's not just more of the same. And it definitely, I think it deserves to be a Hugo nominee, but it's not my favorite of all the stories. Oh, I'm sorry. There was one other thing that I thought was really interesting, which is the whole Babel theme. That's what it was. So there's another story that talks about religion. Mm-hmm. And so this Babel theme does kind of weave itself through the whole story. And it's almost like, I would say that the I don't think this is giving anything away, the alien companion has kind of maybe a little crisis of faith in the story.
Yeah.
When the human reveals something about the past.
Yes.
And it has to do again with this conflict between trust and knowledge, right? Yes. Yeah. The human has knowledge about the past.
And the alien.
And it also has a concept of original sin, and so there's religious elements woven into this story too that are probably appealing to the Mind on Fire crowd out there. So
the people listening to this podcast.
Yeah. So anyhow, I think that wraps up our review of the five Hugo nominated short stories for 2009. My vote is definitely for, so if you had to pick one story, I would highly recommend Ted Chiang's Exhalation. And Catgirl, what would you say?
Article of Faith.
Article of Faith. You know, read those two stories or listen to them. And again, we'll provide the links in our show notes at mindonfire.com.
And
if you have any comments, please leave them there as well.
What's it called? Escape Pod, Podcastle, Pseudopod, they're all free.
Yeah, and we'll nice. We'll include links to those. Also, if you're listening to this podcast before the voting takes place in August, I'm going to include links to all the shorts. The short stories are also available not just as podcasts, but as the text is available online for free as well. So hopefully you catch this podcast before then, and you're able to download those and listen to them or read the text. I just want to do one more little talk about the Hugos, one more little thing. There are five Hugo nominees. I mean, there's nominees for a number of different awards.
There's different categories within the Hugo. There's the novellas, there's the short stories, there's the
novelettes, there's the novels themselves, right? And then they've got graphic stories and dramatic presentations, and I mean, Iron Man's in there, and Wall-E, and if you read graphic novels, then like Why the Last Man, and Fables, and all these other things are nominated as well. And it's if you just find, I'll include a list to all the nominees. It's a great place to go if you just want to find good stories and good media, geeky media to read.
Or
listen. I just want to talk briefly about the best novel. Three of the five best novels are written for teens. They're good for adults as well. Cory Doctorow's Little Brother.
Charlie's, which you can read online.
which he has available as a free download. John Scalzi's Zoe's Tale, which is part of his Old Man's universe, Old Man's War universe. And then The Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman.
Which just won the Newbery.
Yes, yes. It was awarded the Newbery Award.
Which is probably part of the reason it's Hugo nominated, because it's a good book.
Yeah, it's a great book. So,
which I actually haven't read it yet, to be honest.
I've read The Graveyard Book.
Do we own it?
We own it, yeah. It's on the shelf out there. we've both read Little Brother.
Well, I haven't finished it.
Oh, you haven't finished it yet? Mm-mm. Okay. How far did you get?
Pretty far.
Okay. And then I just got done with Saturn's Children by Charlie Strauss. I like Charlie Strauss. He always tells a good story. And I just have Zoe's Tale and Anathem. Anathem is a...
It's actually propping huge, up
the computer. It's propping right up now. The computer right now on top of the writer's market. Two of the biggest books. So
we just need to get like Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Yeah, yeah, and then we'll have that tower up to the ceiling. And that one's by Neal Stephenson. So hopefully we'll hear your own comments. Hopefully you'll have a chance to read some of these stories yourself. And thank you for listening to us. And let's... hopefully you enjoyed also having Cat Girl on board and her
and our various cats.
Yeah, our various cats. But anyhow, this is Cat Girl's inaugural podcast. So big hand for Cat Girl, yay. Okay.
Yay.
So thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next time. We look forward to your comments online.
Bye.